Have you ever wondered why cities are located where they are? Although we humans are terrestrial mammals who survive only a pitifully short time if we're forced off of land and into an aquatic environment, what predicts the locations of our big cities more than anything else is the nearby presence of water. In fact, until the last century or so, cities could not survive without some sort of water access. Oceans, of course, they always have been and still are what connect disparate parts of the globe with one another. So lots of cities are located on the edge of oceans. Logistically, it's much less efficient to bring products from another continent to a city that's located inland, maybe 1,000 miles or more from the nearest coast, than it is to bring goods to a port that's located directly on the ocean. But even so, it turns out that rivers are just as predictive of where a city might be located, or maybe even more important than oceans. In the past, rivers provided clean drinking water, and often they tended to be rich in food and other resources that humans need to survive. And rivers provided transport. In some cases, rivers were basically a pathway that wound through terrestrial landscapes for hundreds of miles. They were like roads, only no one had to whack down brush with a machete or lay a brick. You just had to build a raft and you were on your way. But while rivers have been very good to us humans, we haven't been very considerate back. In the past, we've let all kinds of things fall into our rivers. Crap left over from construction sites, from wastewater plants, power plants, animal parts from slaughterhouses, everyday random trash, dirt, sewage. Yeah. And being cruel to rivers isn't even recent. As many as 7,000 years ago, people were already polluting rivers. In the nation of Jordan, scientists studying this ancient riverbed that now is completely dry found evidence that humans who were only just beginning to learn how to make tools out of metals were dumping copper, lead, zinc, cadmium, arsenic, and mercury into their poor, pretty little river. Plants that grew up along the banks, well, they absorbed those poisons, and then animals like goats and sheep ate the poison plants. And of course, people ate the animals, and they also consumed the plants directly, and so on. We were barely out of the Stone Age yet, and already it was basically Love Canal. Fast forward from then to today. Around the world in the past 50 years, many rivers have been made considerably cleaner. Pollution happens from human inattention, and honestly, polluting probably is normal and natural for humans to do. It's kind of our default setting. Cleaning up is not natural. It's not a default. It happens only when we pause, assess, and engage. So secretly, anytime you run across a spot in a city that's extraordinarily clean and lovely, it's never because it just happens to be that way. Someone had to plan either to preserve its beauty or restore its beauty. Someone you don't know is probably working hard on a consistent basis to keep it that way day by day. Anyway, in the United States, we have a law known as the Clean Water Act that prevented us from treating rivers as sewage pipes and regulated industrial runoff. Other nations did the same kind of doubling down on cleanup in the 60s and 70s. Most industrial nations have it well in hand at this point. For one good example, in London, the Thames River has gone from being a smelly, shameful embarrassment to one of the cleanest urban rivers in the world. And there are other success stories that are similar. On today's show, we're going to talk with a really cool entrepreneurial visionary who's been working on making the Chicago River wilder and freer. And what he's doing reminds me of the move to take wild animals out of captivity and release them in sanctuaries with natural habitat where they can roam around. It's sort of the urban river version of that. He's helping the Chicago River throw off the chains of civilization, throw off oppression, and return to the condition it was in before it was imprisoned, to return the river to its former soft wildness and beauty. I'm Jill Riddell, and this is The Shape of the World.
Hello, I'm Nick Wesley, co-founder of Urban Rivers, a nonprofit working on building the Wild Mile in the Chicago River.
Hi, Nick. Glad to have you on The Shape of the World. You know, I've been following your work for a few years, actually, and since you and I happen to live in the same city, I have to say I've really been enjoying what I see showing up on the river. People describe you sometimes as an inventor, a designer, a tinkerer, someone who thinks up and prototypes clever hacks for ways to improve the river. Does that sound right to you? Or how do you think about your work?
I think I was really influenced by, you know, just seeing industrial design things, like just seeing people who make things that take the environment that you're in and kind of optimize it to a certain way. You know, I think that is kind of something that always draws me towards things, I guess. Yeah.
Nick, for someone who's never been to Chicago, how would you describe what the Chicago River looks like and feels like?
Well, you know, it's got a long reputation for its...
Filthiness?
Filthiness, yes. Lack of hygiene, I guess.
Yeah, I heard you on a video that I watched before we did this interview. I heard you describe it as sort of being like a hallway with a muddy floor.
Yeah. So it's kind of a alien slice of the city. It's this totally isolated and unique habitat that seems to kind of be in its own world of sorts. You know, you have areas that are sunken down. So you have these steel walls that are, you know, 8 to 15 feet high. So you're down low in it. Then there's areas where you have kind of this riprap, this natural edge in some blessed areas, you know, with trees, herons, other things like that. But then the whole time you're kind of in this bowl, you're looking up and you're seeing the city. So it's a very different vantage point within the city itself.
And if you were to approach the river from the land, like you just walked up because you wanted to peer down, like what color is the water or what, you know, what sounds might you hear?
If you were to walk up to the edge of the river itself is kind of a mucky green color. You'd normally see steel, rusted seawall, and then you might get the glimpse of different wildlife throughout. So you might see things like a heron or different birds along the edge there if, you know, you have wildlife.
And is there a sound? Does it make a rushing, swooshing sound?
So it's pretty quiet. I mean, when you're in it, you're surrounded by these big walls. So there's a weird echoey thing down below, but you might hear the things in the neighborhood, though. So, you know, a lot of these are in industrial areas, so you might hear, you know, backup alarms or bulldozers, things like that. You know, other areas, though, are pretty quiet where there's not much around. It's pretty peaceful, especially at night. You know, that's probably my favorite time to be in the river. You know, you go for a night paddle and you're moving through and all you hear is your paddle kind of swishing in the water. You know, you can hear some wildlife moving around. You might hear some bird calls or something like that. You might hear a splash, something jumping in the river. So that is probably the most pleasant time to be immersed in this.
I had a friend that worked with me at the Nature Conservancy a bunch of years ago, who later went on to become the director of the nonprofit organization called Friends of the Chicago River. This was Laureen Von Klan. And back in the 90s, Laureen's goal was to get the Chicago River to a place where it was clean enough that people could splash around in the water and swim. Frankly, at that time, it was so polluted, I thought this was never going to happen. But now, I understand Laureen was an earlier incarnation of Nick, a visionary who saw something the rest of us didn't. Laureen was in communication with a handful of people in other parts of America who were working to improve their urban rivers. They called themselves the Friends of Trashed Rivers. In 1996, that coalition held a conference, and I remember someone attending who was rooting for the revival of the Los Angeles River, which was once that city's primary source of drinking water. Someone else was working on the Rouge River in Detroit, and someone else on the rivers and streams that feed into Lake Pontchartrain on the north border of New Orleans. These ideas have been around, is what I'm saying, in Chicago and around the globe. And in talking with Nick, I was struck by how rivers, even these ones that have been the most harshly domesticated and whose loveliness has been beaten down and taken away from them, continue to hold power and dignity. People continue to want to be near them, want to touch them. There's just something about rivers. Along with Nick's colleagues at Urban Rivers, Nick is famous for having come up with the idea of increasing habitat in the Chicago River by creating these, I guess you'd kind of call them rafts, that are planted with grass seedlings and flowers. They launch the rafts out into the water where they become kind of like tiny houseboats. They're a home for small creatures, the plants, obviously, but also fish, crickets, butterflies, a kind of mussel called the giant floater, And like a houseboat, these miniature ecosystems stay moored in one location. They have a strong relationship with the shore, but they truly are afloat. The rafts are very cool. I've been to see them in this area that's behind the REI store on the city's north side. The other big thing that Nick and his friends are known for is the attempt to turn one full mile of the Chicago River completely wild and natural. This too has gone from a dream to something that's occurring in real life. The so-called Wild Mile is now an actual municipal plan that the city of Chicago is implementing.
So Nick, tell me about the Wild Mile. What does it look like? What's out there?
Yeah, so the Wild Mile, the area that the Wild Mile in looks a lot like many urban rivers throughout the country. It's got steel walls. It's pretty shallow. We don't have a lot of boat traffic going through it. But essentially, we're taking that space, this kind of degraded piece of canal, and turning it into a wildlife sanctuary within the Chicago River. So we're adding floating gardens, different habitat structures for different wildlife, things like mussel habitat, bird habitat, a series of floating gardens that surround a walkway, which people can kind of come down to river level and be really immersed through it. And, you know, this whole thing, it's a linear park throughout it. So an experience where one person can walk from one end to the other and see all these different types of ecological amenities in the river and with the backdrop of the city skyline. So you can see the Sears Tower, you see all of the tall buildings, and then you see all sorts of habitat and wildlife also immersed in there.
So nature right there in the city.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, just a little strip of habitat that runs together throughout the city.
Are you in contact with other people who are also doing work on rivers in other cities in the United States or North America or other continents?
Yeah, absolutely. We're starting to get into a renaissance of sorts where we have these cities that are all lining these rivers, all very densely populated. And this is kind of the last place that you could develop into public open space, and you can create new habitat and environments within. You know, we talk to groups like Flussbad in Berlin. So they have a project where they're trying to create a filter system using plants that then moves into an open swimming pool.
Is that the swimming pool, the one on the Spray River or something like that?
Exactly.
I saw a picture of that. It looks beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that there's a lot of new interest in this. We're going to see more and more of this. Charles River in Boston put in their first kind of bigger garden unit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll have to find out where that is and go see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, I do think that it's also the case that one thing we have going in our favor is simply that we don't ship much by water anymore. So that got replaced by railroads. Once the highway system was built, it became less desirable to transport by water. So the fact that there's less and less water transportation has made this possible as well.
Yeah. Yeah, entirely.
And that's just a big trend, I mean, throughout the world, not just in Chicago. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's where we move to. And when you look at this, it's like, all of the river was created for a different era. There was a whole different set of motives and issues. And now we're looking at it and it's kind of the new opportunities. What can we do with this river? How can we use it to create something that's wild within an urban context?
Right. I really do think you're right. And it has to be made likable. The fact that it's so austere now and frankly can be a bit depressing depending on the edge that you walk up to where you access it.
Yeah.
It has to be made at least a little bit beautiful that people can see that glimmer of hope.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think that's a lot of what the Wild Mile is doing. That's a lot of what your work is doing.
Absolutely, yeah. We were able to install the first walkway section, which is a huge milestone for us. It creates this opportunity where it could be surrounded by these floating gardens near the river. So it creates this kind of new perspective. It was a really impactful project. One of the thoughts of the Wild Mile is how can we reduce the barrier to entry? How can we make it so more people could have experiences like this?
Imagine this. Your living room is a mess. You clean it up and leave for a few hours, and when you come back, it's a mess all over again. For anyone who's a parent of small children, this situation is not at all hard to picture. It's basically your daily life. But now imagine if your living room isn't just yours, and you don't have two or three kids, you have 2 million. That's basically what it's like for anyone trying to remove trash from an urban river. You can't do it from the shore, so you have to get into a kayak or something. You're capable of picking up every single cup and Cheetos bag in one small area, which probably feels pretty good. Then you leave, and when you return the next time, it looks just as cluttered as when you were there before. Instead of moaning about this chronic problem the way I probably would, Nick and his buddies at Urban Rivers invented a solution. Basically, it's this. Imagine a vehicle for the river. It resembles a small barge, and it has this machine arm on it that picks up the garbage floating in the water. And this is really the best part, what if it were run remotely, sort of like the way NASA controls the rover that explores the surface of Mars? And what if anyone, anywhere, at any time could control it?
I know that trash is a problem in the Chicago River, that there's a lot of trash sometimes, and that it blows into the river, people throw it in the river. Tell us about your robotic trash picker-upper.
Yes, the Trashy, the trash robot.
The trash robot.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the issues we saw is there's always litter going in the river, and there's a myriad of different ways it gets in there. But once you get a can in the river, it's going to keep moving. It's either going to get caught on something and then maybe eventually pulled out, or it's just going to keep going until it gets to St. Louis, until it gets to the Gulf, and then eventually to the ocean. And so
that's sad.
Yeah. But, you know, that trash, you know, that same can.
Got to go somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so we were trying to figure out how can we get rid of this? And we realized we need something that's kind of always on because it's very irregular. At first, we tried just a few volunteers and you'd go out at the same time each day, but it would vary. Some days it'd be inundated. Other days you'd find nothing. And then maybe 3 hours later after everyone left, you'd get a bunch more trash.
So it depends on where the wind is blowing, how much rain has fallen, who knows what, right?
Exactly, yeah. And so the idea was, okay, can we make a remote control boat that people could use to remove some of this trash?
So you don't have to get in the river to remove it. You have kind of a Roomba?
Exactly, yeah. And so essentially the way that it worked is it has a camera on it and then a website, and then users were able to kind of control it, drive it around, and pick up the trash.
Oh, that sounds fun.
Yeah.
So I have a question about trash in general. I don't like trash, and no one does. But is the presence of trash a genuinely pressing problem for the ecosystem? So if we were totally rational creatures, what would we prioritize as the number one and maybe the number two, number three things that we would do to improve the ecological condition of the Chicago River? And how does trash rank in that?
Yeah, so I think the number one thing is to create more riparian corridors, more naturalized edges. I think that's really the biggest problem that we currently face.
More habitat, more green, more soil, more plants.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But trash is up there. I mean, depending on the types of trash, the size, different things eat it, and it gets into the whole ecosystem. Someone was opening up some fish, and they found there's plastic in them. You start to see that, and that's really not what you want out of an ecosystem. So,
no, it's gross.
Yeah.
And if you could change one medium-sized thing about the world, if you could just wave a wand and change one thing, what would it be?
I wish people would think more in probabilities rather than absolutes.
Probabilities instead of absolutes. Say more.
I think a lot of times people get stuck into binary decisions where it's one way or the other. You know, this is good, this is bad. Whereas I think there's a million different potential outcomes of something. And I think people need to be more open to the various outcomes that can happen from things and how nothing is really certain. And I think that would help people make better decisions and would help us plan things in a more useful way.
Do you do that instead of thinking, oh, it's got to be like this? Do you think, oh, there's seven different ways it might be? Or how does it show up in your work?
Yeah, I mean, you think, what is the chance of this success? The whole park and the whole project was that. It's not a high probability. You kind of weigh the options. What is the chance that this will succeed, the chance that this will fail? How effective do I think this will be? That helps you make the right choices in different things. You
right.
Know?
That makes a whole lot of sense. I mean, you have this canal that you're calling the Wild Mile. And at this point, it's probably more like a wild few hundred feet.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, that's how everything starts, right? You have to lay the first brick.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. When you look at something like, you look at just how nature works, it is probabilities. You know, it's when we look at our gardens and the amount of plants that succeed or don't succeed, it's really on a curve. So there are areas that might be completely decimated by something and other areas that are really flourishing. And when you take the sum of that, you start to see nothing's going to be 100% successful or 100% a failure.
Right, which speaks so well for why diversity is important. Yeah. If you only plant one type of grass and it turns out the geese totally love that one kind of grass and they just decimate it, then you're left with nothing. But if you plant a diversity of things, it's never a bad year for everything.
Yes.
There's always some kind of plant that's going to do well in a certain type of weather or with certain conditions or certain things maybe going, quote, wrong. Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. So you think in terms of probability rather than absolutes.
Yes, yeah. It's a series of dice rolls, everything we do.
Right. So, Nick, tell me about your collaborators on the projects that you're working on. Who are the other people who are doing good work along with you?
This is not a project one could do alone. A river is a public trust. It takes a lot of different people to put it together. We have a really good relationship with Shedd Aquarium, which brings a lot of people out to remove trash and to study some of the wildlife within the area. We work real closely with the Department of Planning and Development.
A city agency?
Yeah, City of Chicago has been really, really supportive, really forward-thinking in a lot of ways on this. Near North Unity, which is a community organization, helps bring out students and connects a lot of different people to the work being done on the Wild Mile. Obviously, our team is made up of me, Phil Nicodemus, Zach D'Amato, Josh Yellen, and a ton of very dedicated volunteers. About 200 people have been onboarded to come out on a weekly basis. This kind of thing can't be done without a huge group of dedicated people who really want to see this river change and to really be a part of that.
That's exciting. Nick, thank you so much for being on The Shape of the World.
Thank you, Jill. I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
This is Jill Riddell. Thanks for listening to the show today. Another new episode for season 5 is coming out, so expect that. I'll be talking then with Margaret Rinkle, a columnist for the New York Times. Margaret Rinkle will be our first guest on this show who lives in a major city in the American South, so it'll be a chance for us to cover some new territory, both geographically and topically. The Shape of the World is about nature, cities, and people, and the world we share. It's a production of the Office of Modern Composition, a business that creates compositions and fosters composers. If you have a story to tell, the Office of Modern Composition can help. They provide coaching to writers who are working on books or who have a story to tell and want to put it out there in the world in some other medium. They can go all DIY and teach you how to write and produce the story yourself, or they'll do the whole thing for you. Either way, you can end up with a permanent archival piece that presents your ideas and experiences. The Shape of the World is produced in the vital, vigorous, and beautiful metropolis of Chicago in the prairie state of Illinois. The Shape of the World is a completely carbon neutral endeavor, thanks to reductions that we made and from a carbon offset purchased from Tradewater. If you're interested in eliminating your carbon footprint, go to the website tradewater.us. You can find Shape of the World on Instagram and on the website shapeoftheworldshow.com. There you'll find out more about the work of Nick Wesley and a drawing of Nick by the artist Nicole V. Hill. You can also find links to Urban Rivers, the organization Nick co-founded. Check for them at wildmilechicago.com, and they're also easy to find on social media. This episode's audio production was carried out beautifully by Andy Bosnack and Jason Niner. Our Instagram account is managed by Ian Wenzel. The theme music is composed and performed by Brad Wood. Special thank you again to our guest, Nick Wesley.